5,202 pounds. How do they figure that out? From a telescope in Hawaii is beyond me to come up with that kind of a number. So let me drop it. So, okay, let me see if there's any comments or questions. Or, you know, questions dealing with the space program that doesn't necessarily have to do with these topics. This is WS2M. Okay, nothing heard. We've been talking about the moon going, you know, people going to the moon. Dick mentioned it earlier in his opening statement, talking about sooner or later we're going to be going to the moon. Well, the first things that will be going there will be cargo vehicles, and NASA needs a lot of cargo vehicles. So they picked now a total of, well, they had three, but now, you know, now they're up to five different companies that will be able to deliver cargo to the moon. They're going to give them contracts. I think I forget how many billions of dollars are going to be involved in this program, but a couple of billion dollars are involved. And they got a Blue Moon, which is the vehicle that Blue Origin is building to land on the moon. Blue Moon is going to be operated mostly with hydrogen fuel cells. And he's been developing that, but now he's going to get more money to pour into that program. Not that he needs it. That's run by Jeff Bezos. But then the other companies are SpaceX. They're going to use their Starship, an unmanned Starship vehicle, which will be able to land on the moon vertically. They have these doors that will open up. These lanyards and pulleys that are going to come out will be able to lower things to the surface and then drive away from the vehicle, because he's got plans of reusing these vehicles, and they, you know, he plans of blasting off from the moon and returning the starship, they call it, back to Earth. And then a couple of other companies are also involved with this new contract. Sierra Nevada Corporation, SNC, they're the ones that are presently building the Dream Chaser vehicle, which should be ready in a couple of years to bring cargo back and forth to the International Space Station. Dream Chaser will dock with the space station or berth. It will be able to do both, have both capabilities, and eventually come back and land in Florida or any runway. It doesn't have any poisonous gases on board like the space shuttle did. So, you know, you won't need a hazmat group to go out to the vehicle after it lands. So, you know, you could actually land on, you know, a runway that, you know, 747 lands on it. You can go land anywhere. So eventually that company, Sierra Nevada Corporation, SNC, is building now a lunar lander that will also be able to help NASA out. You're going to need tons of supplies. They're going to need power supply stations. You know, you name it. And then, you know, once all your materials are there, it will be a lot easier to send crews to the moon and stay there on a permanent basis by 2028. They plan on landing there by 2024. I think it's wishful thinking. I don't see that enough money is being thrown at that program right now, but for now it is. But this contract here, I wrote it down, $2.6 billion for cargo contracts, split up between five companies. Any questions? This is WS2N. Speaking about the Dream Chaser vehicle, if you've seen what this looks like, it looks like they call it a mini space shuttle. You know, it's like one-fourth of the size of a space shuttle. But, you know, oddly enough, if and when eventually it will carry passengers, you'd be able to carry the same amount of passengers that the space shuttle carried. You'd be able to carry seven people. But for now, it's designed as a cargo vehicle to go up to the space station. But in the back of the this vehicle, there's going to be another, like, cargo type of section attached to it, which is going to have a power supply system. You're going to be able to have solar arrays come out of it, and you'll be able to carry not only pressurized stuff, but unpressurized stuff. You'll be able to bring up equipment to the International Space Station and back down to some degree. But, you know, the vehicle itself, it's all hollowed out to carry equipment. And then the back has this section, large cargo section, and that's the piece that was actually docked first to the International Space Station. And this piece, they gave it a name now. It's called the Shooting Star. And the reason for that is that's the only piece that doesn't come back. So when Dream Chaser leaves the International Space Station, or whatever space station will be visiting, this thing is designed to go anywhere. What they're going to do is they're going to put all the valuable stuff inside of Dream Chaser. Valuable science and things that have to be returned. Sometimes it's 3,000-4,000 pounds worth of stuff that they bring back to Earth. There's also going to be this Shooting Star cargo section. So that's the stuff where they're going to get rid of junk and materials. They're going to load that up with all the trash. And that part, before Dream Chaser re-enters the atmosphere, will separate from Dream Chaser and burn up in the atmosphere. So they gave it a name, Shooting Star, because that's what it's going to do. It's going to look like a shooting star if you were to see this part of it burn up. But the vehicle itself will be able to re-enter the atmosphere autonomously and come back and land in Florida on the 3-mile runway, you know, the same one that the space shuttle used to use. So that's pretty cool. And let me see if anybody has any questions or comments. I had a couple of pictures of what it looks like, but I didn't send it over to Roy. But if you're interested, you bring up Dream Chaser, and you bring up Shooting Star right after that, and you'll have pictures of this module that's going to be attached to it. So everything else on the vehicle is going to be reusable. It'll land, like I said, on a runway. It's got two wheels in the back. The front part where normally a wheel would be, there's no wheel there. It's a skid. And, as it lands, it's just going to have this skid come down. And that's what's going to hold up the front. The skid itself is actually reusable. What's not reusable will be the heat tiles that are on the outside of the skid. The skid will be folded under the Dream Chaser, and that'll take the heat on reentry, and then the skid will open up, and then naturally the bottom part of that skid will be exposed to the ground, and that'll just break off to a million pieces when it hits the ground when it's coming in for a landing. So I thought that was pretty interesting. They got that design pretty well done. Sierra Nevada Corporation comes out of Colorado, and a lot of people haven't heard of it, but they've been probably around for 40 years building equipment on thousands of spacecraft that have taken off from Earth and gone to interplanetary missions and to the moon and all. So they're heavily involved. And they've been building Dream Chaser. This idea came probably around 20 years ago, at least, when they started it with this. They took it over from some of the early attempts from NASA to develop a similar type of vehicle. And NASA actually went with it to some degree. We have one now. It's called the X-37B. X-37B is the one that Boeing built for the defense industry. So they send that up as a spy vehicle. And that stays up for years at a time and eventually comes back and again lands in Florida now. Originally it used to land in Vandenberg Air Force Base. They have a 3-mile runway out there as well. But now it lands in Florida. And they have two of those vehicles. You know, one goes up. They take turns. So this is WSUN. Any questions or comments?
Jackson.
Station, go ahead.
WS2N, WB2 Jackson. The skid sounds like a lame idea. They're going to destroy the skid and the runway every time they land.
Yeah, I know, you would think so, but they say no. They've landed it a couple of times. You know, they've taken the vehicle up, dropped it out of off of a helicopter, and they've landed it out in California. And they said there was really no problem with it. A couple of times they've done it, but yet they don't use a wheel. They don't need it. It adds weight, and this thing they say works just as fine. Yeah, I thought it was kind of weird, but I agree with you. So what are they doing? But this has been under development for a long time. I think it was around 2012 they dropped the first one off of a helicopter. And everything went fine. They used wheels from a F-38 fighter jet, and the wheels weren't that strong. They thought it was good enough just as a test. And the skid held up, the one in the front, you know, no problem, but the wheels in the back, one wheel collapsed and things went over on the side. And, you know, they had to redesign everything. At that time, it was going to be a crew vehicle. But since then, it's now changed to a cargo vehicle. But yeah, they and not the skid itself is not going to be destroyed. Just a couple of tiles, whatever the tiles are, you know, on the outside of that skid. Back to you, GXM, WS.
Just brings back visions of the old illustrations in popular mechanics and popular science, where they in the 60s, where they show you all these great delta wing craft and. They got the tips up, turned upwards, and yeah, pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, I remember that. And you look at the Boeing one; they have a wheel, you know, the X-37B, and that's pretty big, around 27 feet long, and it's about the same size as this. But the X-37B, they encapsulated it inside of. The top of a Atlas V rocket, and they blast it off that way. And they actually gave SpaceX a contract to do one of them. X-37B has gone up five different times, so five successful launches and five successful landing, you know, on wheels. So SpaceX had the contract one time. They launched it on a Falcon 9, they encapsulated it, and they have a 17-foot diameter fairing, and they did it, but then they haven't gotten a contract since. Maybe they just wanted to know that, you know, maybe when I say the Defense Department wanted to know that they had that capability of using another vehicle. It was like a backup, especially in that world, you know, that they use these things as spy satellites. It goes up. First one went up for like, I don't know, 8 months or something, and then this one up, then since then they went up and extended it from into a year, over a year, and then this last one was up 700 and some odd days, almost 2 years before it came back and landed. Any other comments? Okay, I guess not the November 19th just went by, and that was the landing of Apollo 12, the Intrepid, with the lander. You know, Apollo 11 we had Eagle, well, Apollo 12 we had Intrepid, and that's the one that landed in the Ocean of Storms, and it landed on November 19th, 1969, so 50 years since Pete Conrad and Alan Bean landed on the moon surface, and they wanted to really show that they could do a pinpoint landing to some degree. As you remember, the Eagle, Armstrong, was going to land at a certain location. He didn't like the location, and he flew further downrange, and I think he wound up about four miles off from where he was supposed to land. And Pete Conrad, he wanted to go, he says, I'm going to get right out of money. And the goal was to land right near Surveyor 3. Anybody that's older will remember the Surveyor missions. We sent a half a dozen of them to the moon and different various locations on the moon. And they would land, and they had solar panels, and they had these three landing legs. And they would eventually send pictures, video back to Earth. And what they wanted to do is see how close they could land to a Surveyor. They also wanted to see, you know, how it fared, and a real close-up view of, take pictures of it, the surroundings, you know, how the thrust has affected the moon's surface when it landed, and that type of thing. Well, Pete Conrad got so close to this thing, they could walk. They didn't have a rover on Apollo 12, and they were actually able to walk. It was, I think, around 600 feet away from Intrepid when it landed. So they weren't far from the lunar module. And they went over to it. In fact, they brought back the camera. Pete Conrad got the camera off the Surveyor, brought it back, and that eventually went back to Earth successfully. And I thought I'd bring that up. After 50 years, pretty good. They did two EVAs on Apollo 12. And they didn't have a rover, and they walked quite a distance on the two EVAs. I think each EVA lasted almost 4 hours. So the one camera was that Alan Bean had a little trouble with the camera. He accidentally pointed it into the sun when he was on the moon's surface, and fried the tube, and that was it. So they didn't have that particular camera. They had other cameras to take pictures, you know, that NASA eventually got to see when they brought them back. But their TV camera did not function. It didn't last long. And he really had bad luck with the cameras, because on the way back, you know, the parachutes open, you know, they're coming in for a landing. Everything was successful. They got away from the moon, coming in for a landing back at Earth, coming down into the Pacific. And when they hit the water, there was a camera in storage, and it was mounted, or stored above Alan Bean's head. And that camera broke free. I forget how many pounds it weighs. You know, it's not like, you know, today, you know, it wouldn't be like getting hit with a cell phone. It was a heavy camera. Hit him in the head and wound up temporarily knocking him unconscious, you know, right after they landed. He wound up eventually with 7 stitches in his head. So Alan Bean did not have any luck with cameras. And, it's, you know, it's quite odd, because the guy loved scenery. He was an expert painter. He would, for the rest of his life after that, he'd paint scenery of pictures of the space program, and he was pretty good. And he just died recently, too, I think last year. This is WS2N for the to the SpaceNet report. Any questions or comments? Okay, anybody that listens to this part of the net is familiar with the Starship that's being built by Elon Musk. And Starship is his goal, his long-term goal to fly to Mars. But in the interim, he's got to eventually get to the moon. And before that, he's got to be able to launch this thing off the planet. Right now, he's very successful with all his Falcon 9 rockets. Falcon 9 Heavy. Falcon 9 Heavy is three Falcon 9 rockets that are put together and blasted off as one. He's done that successfully two times. Three times. Yeah, he's done that three times. His big thing now is to build a Starship. And he's building two presently. He's got one being built in Texas, down in Boca Chica, Texas, and he's building another one in Florida, right near where the Falcon 9s get blasted off. And he's calling the one down in Texas Mark 1, MK-1, and the other one's MK-2 in Florida. And his goal is to launch one of these. In this case, it was going to be MK-1. He wanted it launched up to 12 miles high, have it re-enter the atmosphere, and land vertically. Now, this is a big thing. The first stage alone is as big as the whole Falcon 9 rocket. You know, it's like 250 feet high. Well, he's not launching that part yet. He's happy to launch the second stage. The second stage is going to be a second stage, and it's also going to be the payload / passenger compartments. You know, for astronauts to fly in, he thinks eventually he can put like 30 or 40 people in this thing. So the goal is to fly Starship eventually into orbit and bring it back, and then eventually to the moon. And he plans on going from there. And about, you know, starting off with cargo and eventually with crew. So he built Starship, the second stage. He's starting to build the first stage a little bit, but you know that's going to be a lot more massive than the second stage. And his goal is to eventually have like seven engines attached to the to the second stage, and these are all brand new engines, the Raptor engines, and it has, he's worked it with one engine so far, successfully launched a vehicle, went over up around 500 feet and landed successfully. Now his goal was to put three engines into this second stage Starship and launched that 12 miles high. So the other day he said, okay, it's time to test fueling. He wants to put all liquid methane in this. He's not going to use RP-1. He's not going to use the standard fuel that most people are using, the refined kerosene. He's going to liquefy methane gas and use that as a fuel. And, of course, liquid oxygen. So he decides, okay, we're gonna not only we're gonna see if these tanks hold this kind of volume of liquid methane, which is millions of gallons of fuel. So he starts fueling it, and then he also wanted to test the pressure limits. Sure enough, a couple of days ago, he filled it. I don't know how far he filled it up, but the whole top blew off. Didn't explode, but under pressure, the top dome, you know, if you're inside a rocket, you know, you've got these cylinder fuel tanks, and you have a dome on the bottom and a dome on top. You know, essentially, caps on the top and bottom. And sure enough, it overpressurized, and ba-boom, and the whole top blew up, and in fact, he said the bottom part blew loose, too. I don't know what he's going to do to correct this problem. I think these are all carbon composite tanks. I still haven't found out yet. The you know, what they're exactly made of. Original plans were carbon composite. The vehicle itself is made of stainless steel. You know, I don't know if he's going to opt to just have the stainless steel as the barrier, or does he have something in between? I don't have the design yet of what this looks like, but apparently, my guess is probably a carbon composite fuel tank that blew. So, you know, he doesn't think it's going to set him back. You know, I heard this, or I saw pictures of it down in Texas, and it didn't look good. I mean, the smoke was going up miles into the air, and blew the cap. They said pretty far away from the, you know, when I said a cap is like 30 feet in diameter away from the vehicle. So it didn't look good to me, but he says it's not going to slow him down. He's got to start on his third iteration. He's got MK1 that just blew up. MK2 is still in construction in Florida, and he's got Mark 3 that he's now just going to start rebuilding, but, you know, a better design. And instead of just planning on launching and testing to see if this thing would go up 12 miles high and back down, he's going to skip that part. All right, that's it. We're going to go to orbit with the second. So he's hoping to be able to launch this thing into orbit and then somehow deorbit it, have it glide. If you want to call it glide, it's going to come down like, you know, like a somebody jumping out of an airplane, like a parachutist, you know, with his arms out. It's just going to come down, you know, and he's got a heat protecting type of tiles that he's tested. He thinks they're going to hold up good, all on one side of the vehicle. The top side, he doesn't need it. It's all made out of stainless steel instead of aluminum. And we'll see how he does. Originally, he was going to test this 12-mile-high flight this, you know, by the end of this year. So I'm sure that's been put off to probably to early next year. But, yeah, I mean, he's gung-ho. Let's put it that way. This is WS2N. If any questions or comments... Okay, with that Starliner, it's not Starship, but Starliner is now being put on top of a Atlas V rocket. It was constructed down in Florida. Boeing took over the integration facility that NASA used to use for shuttle. So there was this big empty building, and now they're mass-producing Starliner vehicles that are eventually going to carry a crew of four. Well, now they're going to take their first one, they've already done it now, and board it over to a Launch Complex 41, and hoisted that up to the top, and presently putting it on, installing it on top of the second stage of an Atlas rocket. Atlas rocket consists of first stage, second stage. First stage is all liquid kerosene and liquid oxygen. And the top stage is a cryogenic job. It's liquid hydrogen and liquid helium. So we'll see how that works out. It's called a Centaur rocket, Centaur up stage. They've always, well, not always, but most of the time when Atlas launches, it has one Centaur rocket on it. And now with this setup, they're going to have, because it's a heavier weight, they're going to use two Centaur rockets side by side, you know, not one on top of one another. And so it's a much bigger vehicle, much bigger tank of liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And they're going to have two solid boosters attached to it when this thing goes up. And this is a, you know, a crewed vehicle. The only difference is they're not going to put a crew on it. This is very similar to what SpaceX did back in March when they launched the Dragon vehicle up to the International Space Station without a crew. It docked with the space station autonomously. First time they used the new international docking adapter, the ITER, that was installed by astronauts not too long ago. And then you actually had people, you know, crew members on the International Space Station go into the Dragon crew vehicle, took pictures and inaugurated it, you know, left, and eventually the crew vehicle disembarked and went back and landed in the Atlantic Ocean. Well, Starliner is going to do the same thing. It will launch, dock with the space station. Again, you're going to have a crew go inside. They'll take some pictures, and then it will eventually deorbit and come back and land again. Not in the Atlantic Ocean, not in the Pacific Ocean. This one's going to land at White Sands, New Mexico, on dry land. It has these big airbags that are going to come out and protect the what would be a crew in this vehicle. And they hope to do that within probably 3-4 months, try to get a crew to get to the International Space Station. They have to do a couple of other things first, and this is one of them. Looking forward to see if Starliner gets off the ground, and not too long from now, for this test vehicle to be launched. A couple of weeks, actually. The date set for launch of the test vehicle is December 17th. And, you know, the way things go in space, my guess is probably going to be delayed a little bit, but we'll have to find out as time goes on. Personally, I think they're going to probably make it, because I haven't heard any problems in developing the system. After that comes back, they don't have any other tests to do. Only SpaceX does. Both SpaceX and Boeing had the choice from NASA. They could opt out of doing an in-flight abort test, you know, or not. They both have successfully done a pad abort test where, you know, you put the vehicle on a pad on the ground, duplicate sitting on top of a booster, duplicate having a booster blow up, and you know, the idea is to bring the crew to safety. They shoot about a mile away from the pad, about a mile high, parachutes open up, and the crew would come down and land safely. They both successfully have done that. SpaceX back in 2015, and then a few months ago was about a month or so ago was Boeing Starliner. SpaceX does want to do an abort, in-flight abort test. Boeing has opted not to do it. They don't feel they need it. NASA is agreeing with that. SpaceX wants to do it. So they're going to launch a Falcon 9 rocket from Florida, probably within a month or two, with the Dragon crew vehicle on board. And they're going to, you know, simulate an inboard, in-flight abort test and separate from the crew vehicle. And they're going to find out how that works. If that's successful, then they'll get in line, be able to send a crew. They plan on sending a crew of two to the International Space Station. Boeing plans on sending a crew to three, you know, for that first test. And then as time goes on, the idea is to send four people up at a time. Once everything is operational by both these companies, SpaceX and Boeing, they'll be launching four people at a time to the space station, which is good because you have a standard six-person crew on board the space station now. When they have that, they have two Soyuz vehicles attached to the space station. When you send a Boeing Starliner up or a Dragon SpaceX Dragon crew vehicle up with four at a time, you'll be able to have seven people on board the station on a permanent basis, which will give them many, many more hours of science to return to the scientists on Earth. They'll be able to dedicate a lot more time. That one extra person, they estimate the amount of time they're actually going to double the time for science, which is, you know, what we're all, as far as I'm concerned, what we're all about. And, of course, we'll be able to have, you know, our ham radio contact. So probably be able to increase the amount of ARIES schedules that they make with schools here on Earth. So that's pretty much it from for WS2N on the SpaceNet report. Does anybody have any comments or questions? If not, we're going to turn it back to K2RIW.
My audio's not coming through. I guess I hear why. Well, that was TechNet number 1,700. What's the number? 1,772. I'll turn it over to Roy for him to repeat his addresses. And we'll call it a night. AC2GS for the final K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and as always, let me remind you of the appropriate links and email addresses. If you have any questions of a technical nature for the mailbag for Dick, if you have any questions or comments you want to make to Paul, if you have any questions or topics you'd like me to cover, or disagree with me about something, or have a puzzler that you'd like to suggest to me, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at, my call sign is alphacharlie2gulfsierra.com. And there is links to the Nano VNA. There's links to the stories and the Archimedes group. And I even have an image of the Dream Chaser that Paul mentioned during his report. And you can see all those at roy.ac2gs.com. As always, I want to thank Dick for giving me the opportunity to do this every week, and thank everyone out there who listens and participates, and wish everyone a very happy and healthy Thanksgiving coming up. So this is AC2GS73, and I'll be clear.
Thank you, Roy. Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye, you all. K2RIW clear. See you guys next week.
We'll be back here next Sunday, hopefully. And of course, we have the ClubNet, the Club InfoNet, on tomorrow night at 8:30 on this frequency. We'll try to make that. And that's it. Like I say every week, go LIMAC, go TechNet. Bye-bye.
That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. that tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
KG2 T-Mobile listening.
W2VL repeater.
WB2ZSE, are you listening today? WHCDM. Good morning, Andy. KG2T. Oh, hi. How you doing? I haven't heard you in a while. Actually, I heard you on, I think, UHF last week. I think you were talking. How are things? It's a good old Monday morning. To me, it's another day. All right, Andy. Doing good. Can't complain. A little bit chilly. But otherwise, okay. Yeah, I've been on UHF, and sometimes coming out of Selden on, VHF. But this morning I'm going to a dental appointment in New Hyde Park. So here I am on the good old 8-5. Anyway. By the way, I got a... dig into my linear amplifier. I don't know why, but it's popping fuses. So something is wrong inside. It's funny because it's popping the line fuse, not the internal one.
Yeah, well, the if there's a heavy load on the transformer, that'll reflect back to the primary, and you'll blow the primary fuse. So that, you know, that makes sense. Yeah, check to see if you have any shorts on the B plus line. But make sure, in case you don't, make sure it's discharged first. Because that's 2,000 or more volts on there. And you could have a short on your B+, which could do it. Maybe you got a shorted diode. One of the high voltage diodes are shorted out. You just need one. It could be a string of them. And usually it's not a capacitor. You know, they don't, you know, the high voltage caps usually don't short out. They, you know, as far as what I've seen, they do become less capacity, have less capacity over time. You know, they develop internal series resistance, but the high voltage ones usually don't. You know, unless it's really, really old, it could start to leak. So, yeah, check that and see. And, of course, you know, when you do it, remove the tubes. Take the tubes out completely. So that'll eliminate any tube issues. And then, and if the proper way to do it, let me let it drop. Stand by. Let me just unkey. Yeah, the right way to do it is you have a variac. You turn up the voltage slowly, and you watch the current draw. And if you see the current is rising pretty quick, then you know you got a problem. So, you know, then you won't blow a fuse that way. The other way to do it, it's for protection, is put a 100-watt light bulb in series with your line going to the amplifier. And if your bulb lights up very bright, you know, almost like the 100-watt brightness, then you know you got a short, you got a problem. That bulb should be pretty dim. So, that's another way to protect the amplifier. Put a light bulb in series with the primary line, and just to see if you're drawing too much current. So there's a number of ways of doing it, but usually it's a pretty simple thing. It's not hard to find. You just have to trace it out.
Yeah, you know, the amplifier, it's a very simple device. There's really not much into it. The biggest thing is really the voltage tripler on the power supply to get you the 2,500 volts voltage. But I think probably what it is, Andy, if I'm going to make a guess, it's in the ALC board, because I had to replace the trim pot on the ALC board. It had burnt out. But the other component visually looked okay. So I have to open it and see, you know, if I visually see anything wrong. And if not, like you said, I'll do a check. But on the power supply, I think it was 2 years ago, Andy, I replaced the whole thing. You know, it's got six caps. And if I remember, I think it's a total of 12 diodes. To give me the 2,500 volts. So, they'll give me something to do. You know, now that I'm retired, I got plenty of time. And then after that, I'm going to, you know, put it on swap and shop once it's fixed, see if I can sell it.
Who makes the amp? What model?
It's an amplifier from our generation, Andy. It's a Dantron MLA2500B. The 50 watts in, 2kW out.
Okay. What tubes does it use?
The ceramic ones, 88, I think it's either 74 or 75. And I have, by the way, spare set of match tubes also, brand new. The original iMac tubes.
Yeah, those ceramic tubes are pretty rugged. And they don't, I like using ceramic tubes, actually. Their efficiency is good, and they're more rugged than some of the other tubes that they use in amplifiers. But, okay, that sounds good. Yeah, and Dentron makes some good stuff. They made the antenna tuners also, which are good. But I would go, Yeah, if I would open it up, I would never use a digital meter for checking high voltage for a number of reasons. Hopefully you have a Simpson 260 VOM, because that's the industry standard, and that's what I use. And that has a, at least, mine has a 5,000 volt input scale. You could move the test lead over to that banana jack, and you could measure up to 5,000 volts, which is good. And of course, as a capacitor discharges, you can watch it, watch the meter decay slowly. I would not use a digital meter for checking high voltage, but that's the first thing I would do is I would, if you have a Simpson, put a meter across the plate, the ground, and see if you have any shorts. See what the resistance is. Normally, you should, if it's in good shape, you should see the capacitor charge up once you check the voltage, make sure there is no voltage on it. Then you could go to the ohm scale, R times one, and that's what I'm talking about, a Simpson VOM. And you watch the capacitors, high voltage caps charge up. You've probably seen that before. But obviously, if there's a short, you're going to see a much lower resistance, and it's going to be steady. And there is there's probably a bleeder resistor across the output of the high voltage line, and that's and they could have bleeders across each capacitor also in series. They probably do with a small bypass capacitor across that. And a few other components. So, alright. Yeah, I know about retirement. When you retire, you don't have enough time to do anything because you got too many things to do.
Well, I tell you, Andy, I'm getting to enjoy what I enjoy to do. Including my hobbies. You know, it's a shame, really, that where I am in this condo here, they don't allow antennas, at least beam antennas outside with a tower. That's why I'm going to then put on swap and chop. I think I'm going to do some semi-QRP work with some kind of an antenna in the attic. Or maybe put a loop antenna on the deck in the back and see how it goes. By the way, that's the beauty about being retired. You know, at least if, like most of us hams, you know, we are hobbyists. And that's why we got into this hobby, and that's why we got into our jobs. Because we like to, with our hands, and experiment, and not have plenty of time to do it, or at least as much time as I want to put into it.
Yep, exactly. That's what retirement's about. It's good. Yeah, it's good to retire. And, yeah, I've been semi-retired for a while. I'm still working, but part-time. So I get the best of both worlds, I guess, because I work, and then I have days off, like today, and so on. Yeah. That's why I said what I said. There's no, you got so many things to do. You don't have time for anything because you're so busy with everything else. Yeah, and okay, I'm living in a what do they call it? HOA, a restricted area. I guess there's advantages and disadvantages to that, also. Well, one of the things that I would like to do today, if I get a little bit of time, is start raking my leaves, since now finally the trees behind my house, which are not my trees, they're my neighbor's trees, have started to fall. And last week they were green, and all of a sudden, like overnight, they turned yellow, and now they're falling. So it happened pretty quick. So now my backyard grass is getting piled up with leaves. But luckily, I bought one of those yard vacuums that just takes the leaves and turns it into mulch. So it's an easy process. So I'm gonna
get rid of the leaves and start working on that. Get ready for the colder weather when hopefully it doesn't arrive, because I don't like the cold. So that's another job to do, which probably you don't have to worry about. Back to you.
Yeah, this is KG2T. That's one of the advantages of being in a condominium like I am, you know, 55 and over. You know, I pay a monthly fee to the HOA, and they take care of everything. What's going on here in the southern state? At exit, 25. Wow, cops, ambulances on both sides. I'm coming up to it. I wonder if it was an accident or what it is. I'll give you a report a little bit later. But, I remember those days, Andy. You know, it was a pain in the neck, but you know what? It's enjoyable. So it's like snow blowing. Yeah, a lot of people would say, oh, you know, snow this, snow that. But I had some good power tools, and I didn't mind doing it. As a matter of fact, I used to do, when I was in New Hyde Park, mine, oh, let's see what it is. There must have been an accident here at some point, and somebody maybe died. Because I see on the side, there's, the typical cross and flowers, and there's two cars parked on the side. And I guess the cops come over and told them to move. I don't know. But, in a way I miss those days, Andy, but I'm glad I don't have to worry about it. But somebody will do it for me. And going back on what we were talking about, the 60, the 260 is the old reliable, Andy. I've had a Simpson 260 since I was in my early 20s when I first got started. And to me, like I have also a couple of Fluke meters. You know, nothing beats the 260. Nothing beats you seeing that that needle moving in one direction or the other.
Okay, yeah, so yeah, I figured you'd be one of the few who know what a 260 is. And, because as time goes on, less and less people know what they are and how to use them and so on. It's something that I'm considering showing at the Radio University that's coming up, because we're going to be giving one of the forums on test equipment, and that's a very basic piece of test equipment which everyone can have at a pretty reasonable price, especially that they've come down in price quite a bit. You can still buy them new, and they still sell them, but you can get them on eBay, so not that much. It's a nice meter. And, of course, being a Simpson meter, it's also very rugged. So, it's almost impossible to break the case, the plastic case. It's really, it's a nice meter. Triplett also makes a meter, too, which is nice. I have both types. Yep, so that's good. You don't have to rake any leaves or things like that. But I don't mind doing it. I actually, I don't mind getting on my hands and knees and pulling out weeds, strangely enough. Something about, you know, getting back to nature. Or getting back to the earth. You know, just gardening, which I've never grown a garden, which I could. I know people who have, and that's a lot of fun, too. Grow your own vegetables and so on. That's nice. All right, and okay on the accident. Yeah. All right. So this week's Thanksgiving already. I can't believe it. You know, it just feels like yesterday was summer. And here it is already Thanksgiving week. Wow. All right, I just remembered. I want to make a quick phone call before I forget. Because it just occurred to me. Something that I wanted to do earlier, which I didn't do. So I'll be right back if you're going to be around.
Yep. All right, Andy. By the way, I did break my first 260. I was on top of a 12-foot ladder. And stupid thing fell down on a cement floor. Cracked the glass, cracked the case. And that's when I bought a new one. But that goes back a good 20 years ago or more. And I finally got rid of the old one when I got the new one. I still love it. I wouldn't mind getting another one, but, you know, one is